Welcome to the Free Speech Nation podcast with me, Andrew Doyle. On today's podcast, my guest is Jaspreet Kaur, who is the author of Brown Girl Like Me. Jaspreet is a history teacher, a writer, spoken word artist, and is also a research fellow at Birkbeck University's Centre for British Political Life. I hope you enjoy the podcast. Jaspreet, thank you very much for joining me today. Congratulations on the book.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
I very much enjoyed reading it, and it describes itself as the essential guidebook and manifesto for South Asian girls and women. So I'm not necessarily the target audience, but I very much enjoy hearing about other people's perspectives and life experiences that I haven't ever heard before. Mm-hmm. One of the things I found very interesting is you say that you wrote the book almost that you were imagining your younger self and the things that your younger self would want to hear. Can you talk to me a little bit about that and that process?
Yes, definitely. And I'm glad you mentioned that. I know we're targeting the book to Asian women and girls, and we're calling it a guidebook and manifesto for them, but it's absolutely for everybody to read. And I'm so glad to see different demographics and different genders and different backgrounds reading this book, because it's so important for us to learn about these different perspectives that aren't our own. Yeah. So I'm really happy to hear that. But it honestly is a book that I always wished existed. It was the book that I wish I had growing up as an Asian girl who was born and raised here in East London, and with growing up in quite a multicultural and diverse area. But then as I grew up, feeling like Asian women were just being completely ignored and completely erased from kind of mainstream media, mainstream education. And I just wasn't seeing Asian women represented anywhere. And that was quite confusing, because I was obviously growing up in an Asian family, would see Asian women around myself and would learn about Asian women in the home. But outside of that, I just didn't see ourselves anywhere. And I just wish I had a book like this to help guide me through a lot of the experiences and what I then went through as a teenager and as a young Asian woman in university, in the workplace, and then also navigating all those parts of what makes us an Asian and brown woman. Everything from kind of body image to navigating education systems to microaggressions in the workplace. This book just didn't exist. So after years of complaining that it didn't exist and spending some time researching whether there were any other books like this out there, the last book like this was written by an amazing activist and writer. Her name was Amrit Wilson, and it was written in 1978. And that was the last book for Asian women with this kind of collective voice and this kind of sharing the experiences of what it's like to be an Asian woman in Britain. And that was crazy to me that for four decades, we've had no update. We've had no other literature about our experiences. So yeah, enough complaining, and just set out and wrote it.
Well, I mean, you say it's a manifesto, but it's very much a memoir. You know, it's very much about you and about your process and about your various experiences. Mm. I think that's a very interesting way to try and make a point, in other words, to root it in things that have happened to you.
Yeah.
But you're very open in the book about things. You know, and is that part of also what you felt was missing in terms of the literature?
Yeah.
Around this community?
I guess that was definitely intentional, of wanting to share my own personal anecdotes and my own personal stories. And each chapter opens with a personal story and then goes into that particular theme or topic, because I didn't want it to just be an academic text. I didn't want it to just be a memoir and an autobiography about my life. I wanted it to encompass my experiences, lived experiences of other Asian women. I interviewed around 150 Asian women for this book, as well as a number of different historical theories, political theories, social theories. So it's definitely got that academic lens in it as well. So I wanted to combine all three of those things, because I think individually, those types of themes and those types of writing do hold power. I feel memoirs are fantastic. Academic books obviously hold space as well. But for a topic like this, I wanted to weave those things together to show these things are real. Women are experiencing them, women like myself. So sharing those stories, but also unpacking why they're happening, what kind of structures are at play that allow these experiences to happen? What things might we need to untangle and challenge to make our lives a better place? So that's why it has got lots of my own personal experiences in there. And I was a little bit scared about that, because I was like, whoa, I'm being really vulnerable here. I'm opening up about everything from body hair to my mental health experiences. This is me being really vulnerable. So that was quite scary. But I've known that with the work that I've been doing over the last 6 years, when I've been sharing my own personal experiences, that does make a difference. It makes other women feel like they're not alone.
Yes.
It makes other people feel more empathetic to the issue or the cause because it feels more real coming from a real voice. So yeah, I'm glad I did. I'm glad I was honest and I was glad I was vulnerable with this book. Obviously, there were certain things I did want to hold back on, but the experiences that I knew were going to help other people, I was happy to share and happy to be open about.
But also it's that idea that you reiterate a number of times in the book, which is that by writing about your experiences, you almost work through them.
Mm.
And something you say a couple of times is that poetry saved your life.
Mm.
And you're quite clear about this idea that the process of having to articulate what you've experienced and what you think about what you've experienced actually draws you to a better understanding of it. Would you say that that's happened with this book as well as your poetry, the idea of writing about it?
Yeah.
Has it changed your perspective of your own experiences?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's, like I've said for years, and absolutely with poetry or even writing this kind of work, whether it's narrative nonfiction, I think there's something really empowering about writing your truth and getting it out onto paper and not just in your mind and not just holding it in your own body, in your own mind, and actually getting it out and getting it onto paper. And I felt that with poetry for a long time. And that was something I was doing since I was like 13, 14, using poetry as a form of therapy, as an outlet, as a form of creative expression. But even with a book like this, even with a narrative nonfiction, actually writing these things into existence made it feel more real and then also allowed me to improve on the areas I wanted to improve or share the knowledge that I know will help other people. So, yeah, I've said it was a really healing experience to write this book, which sounds really wishy-washy and so healing. But it honestly was. I finished that last chapter. This was all during the pandemic as well when the world was upside down. I did have the time to slow down and obviously couldn't go anywhere. I was just at home, like many of us were, writing this book and just allowed myself to slow down, process everything I've gone through in the last 30 years, but now know how I want to exist going forward. So it was really healing. I felt like I finished that last chapter and was like, oh, like a huge weight had been lifted of stuff that I'd been holding in for a really long time.
Because you talk about how it's been quite a long So this has been a long, many years in the making.
Many years.
It's not just something that's just come out. And you can see that from the way that you describe things. I am interested in the poetry. So did you go from, you say you were always writing poetry, but did you ever envisage that this would be, you know, that this would be something you would do professionally, you know, or was it just about self-expression at that point?
Yeah, no. I had no idea that this was now going to be my career. This was now going to be my life journey of now being a teacher, poet and writer. That was never something I even thought was possible. When I first started writing when I was 13, it was honestly a way to manage the anxiety I was going through as a teenager. I was suffering from panic attacks. And because I was growing up in quite a traditional Punjabi family, we didn't talk about mental health and didn't have access to mental health services at that point. It's definitely changed now. I'm definitely in a healthier place of talking about mental health in my family. But back then, poetry was all I had. Writing was all I had. And growing up in an Asian immigrant family, becoming a poet, becoming a writer, that's like, what? Like, that is not even a prospect. That's not even an idea. Like, we're all being encouraged to be doctors, dentists, lawyers, accountants. And I've mentioned that in the book about the pros and cons of encouraging our kids to stay in these professions and go into these professions. But yeah, growing up in that kind of environment of get a good job. Well, first of all, get a good education, work hard, get a good education. And me and my siblings were the first in the family to go to university. From that, go get a secure and good job. Yeah. And that's what we were told to do, because you can imagine for my parents' generation, my grandparents' generation, who have migrated from Punjab in the early 60s with nothing and have set this foundation for my family and us kids. It's about now kind of continuing up from that foundation. So the creative arts that was never an option. That was like not even something I would ever consider. But I think my parents always knew I was the rebel child out of myself and my three other siblings. I'm the youngest of four. They've all gone into quite traditional career routes. One of my brothers is a doctor, golden child. Yeah, one of my brothers is an accountant. My sister went into HR. So all jobs that were kind of really secure career paths and really respected. And my parents knew I wanted to be a teacher, which also to them was quite a secure career. But I wanted to go on and study history, gender studies, sociology, which was also a bit like, okay, that's quite different for them to get their head around. But okay, they understood history. When I wanted to do a master's in gender studies, they're like, well, what is this? What is gender studies? Like, that was quite a journey for us all to go on of saying, no, I really want to study feminist theory. I really want to study masculinity. They knew I was going on a slightly different path than kind of the traditional route. And at that stage, when I was at uni, was when I started to share some of this poetry. And for years, I'd been keeping it to myself, as I said, as a form of therapy, never shared it with anybody. I was not the person I am today. I was quite an introverted, shy, didn't have much self-confidence. So getting on a stage and performing a poem would have been the last thing I ever thought I would do.
It makes you very vulnerable, doesn't it?
Like, yeah.
Not just because it's your work, but is you delivering your work.
In front of a live audience that's going to react in all kinds of ways. And I got to a point, I was doing my master's in gender studies, and I was writing a thesis on a really hard-hitting topic on son preference in the South Asian community and this ongoing issue of preferring a son over a daughter. And I wrote this 20,000-word thesis and was really passionate about it, really wanted to get the word out there of making change about this kind of cultural issue. But I knew not everyone had the time to read a 20,000-word paper. So I thought, let me summarize that research into a poem. Mm-hmm. I've been doing this for years. I can summarize it and maybe that will get people to listen.
Yes.
So I wrote this poem. It was called Queens and Corpses. And it ended up being the first poem I performed at an open mic night in London. It was over in West London. I was in East London. I thought, okay, no one knows me there.
It's safe.
It's safe. If it goes really bad, I'll never do it again. Just run back home. And I performed that night and somebody in the audience was filming it on their phone, uploaded it online, and it went viral the next morning. And I woke up seeing it everywhere,
right,
all over the UK, Australia, Canada, North America, India. And then can also feel that night how it impacted that audience. And I could just feel that energy in the room. I could feel it from the audience of like, they were like, okay, we really need to be changing our perspective on how we see our sons and daughters. And it really started this really important conversation. And that's when I realized, I was like, there's a real power in the creative arts of talking about these taboo topics, these stigmatized topics, these social, cultural issues. Art can be the accessible way to do this. So I started performing at more open mic nights. And this is when I've just started as a teacher. So I'm teaching 5 days a week, performing at open mic nights, two, three nights a week. And those of us who know what a teacher's schedule is like, it's exhausting. So that graph, those 5 years were tough, but it's now led me to where I am today and even this book even existing. So it was quite a journey. And even though my family and myself were quite scared to start this poetic journey, it's now it's shown how beneficial it can be.
Yeah. But that topic of son preference, and because you quote some statistics that really shocked me, actually, about the number of girls that are missing as of today. Do you feel that this, you know, and obviously there are certain countries where that is particularly a problem, where to have a daughter is seen as a financial burden, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Do you feel that writing about that in this country, but that it can penetrate into those other areas in the world, maybe through the viral element of the poetry?
Yeah, this is it. This is why arts can be a really kind of global way to have some of these discussions. And social media can also play a role in that too. And I've mentioned this in the book about kind of my love-hate relationship with social media over the years. And on the one hand, it's been really beneficial to a person like myself who grew up in a background that didn't necessarily have some of the kind of social and cultural capital to share my work out with the world or get at the top of a publisher's desk. I had to use digital media, social media, to get my message out there and get my work out there. And that allowed some of this work to end up being global. So some of these conversations could happen over in South Asia as well. And what I was trying to highlight is that these things aren't far away problems, how they're sometimes perceived as, okay, that's happening all the way over there. It's not. Like, these things are happening in our homes, even here in the Western world as well. So how can we have these discussions here in the diaspora, in the UK, in Britain, but how can we also have some impact over there as well in our home countries too? So, I think the digital age has allowed these conversations to now become global.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's also opened a massive cesspit of, you know, just...
That's
just
the hate side of social media, the dark side of it too.
It feels like conversations can't really happen very well. You can get a message out there and things can go viral,
yeah,
but then when it comes to having sort of that nuanced conversation, it's not
Yeah.
It always gets scuppered.
Yeah.
Is my feeling.
And as someone who's a historian, someone who's taught history and studied history, like that idea about nuance and that idea about understanding context and motive and audiences and understanding kind of how things aren't black or white. There's a lot in between that is grey. The digital space doesn't always allow us to think like that. So that's definitely the hard side. With some of these topics, it's quite clickbaity, it's a quick quote or it's a snippet from a video and you're not really getting sometimes to the really kind of nitty-gritty stuff to have conversations around some of these topics.
I mean, when you're talking about the experiences of immigrant communities within this country, that's a complicated thing that requires more nuance. It requires, I mean, to take the example, as you said, I think I saw an interview with you where your mother was asked what she wanted you to be, and straight away it was dentist. She said that initially it was, you know. And I had a similar thing when I was teaching at a school, which was most of the kids were from an Asian background, and I was teaching drama. And there were kids that would say they really wanted to do it, but their parental expectation just wouldn't let it happen. So on the one hand, you want to be culturally sensitive and sensitive to differences between cultures.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you also want what is best for the kids and what the kids want to do.
Yeah.
And so that's actually quite difficult to negotiate. You know, do you have any advice for people in that sort of situation where, you know, they don't want to be offensive to another culture, but the kid's telling them, I want to do this.
It's really difficult because, you don't want to offend, but you're also trying to encourage this young person to follow their dreams, follow their passions, follow what they want to do. So for myself, I've been doing a lot of work in this space within the South Asian community of getting out there, showing them what it is that I do, showing them that it can be a sustainable career. And I think that's where a lot of the fear comes from. If you're thinking about where the mindset is coming from for a lot of these families and a lot of these parents, it's coming from a good place. Their intention is that they don't want their child to be financially insecure and to struggle and to go through the hardships that they went through. So I think understanding their context sometimes really helps. Where is that fear coming from and where are those emotions coming from?
I mean, that makes sense, doesn't it? You're wanting financial security.
Of course.
Because, you know, the artistic career, that's not stable. Right.
It's, and what I've been trying to talk to parents about and young people about is how do you make this career sustainable?
Right.
And how have I done this? How have I made this a job that allows me to get X amount in each month so I can cover my mortgage, my bills, my whatever, and live a healthy and happy life? So that's what I've been doing, trying to talk to going to schools, talking to parents, talking to young people about how can you make this sustainable? And there is also the importance of getting people of color, South Asian communities, say young South Asian kids into these careers, because if we're not taking up space in these different industries, whether it's books, whether it's film, whether it's storytelling, whether it's other creative art forms, what's going to happen is we're still going to see other people telling our stories for us. And that's what's been happening for a very long time because we haven't been in those spaces. And then we'll see these continuous kind of tired stories and these outdated stereotypes and these tired narratives coming out time and time again because we're not in those spaces to share our voice. So it is important that we're there and getting our young people to go into these different creative avenues so that we can take up space there and we can shift the storytelling and shift the narrative in a way that is more authentic to us. So there's also that important part of it as well. We need to be in those spaces to make some of this change happen.
It feels like there's been a lot of progress though in that, in that respect. You know, in terms of, I think when I was growing up, you wouldn't have seen anywhere near as much or heard from people from various communities really all that much.
Yeah.
And now you really do. You know, I think things have got better.
Yeah, no, I grew up in the age where the only place I saw Asian women on TV was Goodness Gracious Me and Bend It Like Beckham. That was the only two examples I can give you. And now we're seeing Asian women in top Netflix shows. Bridgerton has done excessively well. We've seen Riz Ahmed now winning an Oscar. There's definitely a shift happening now. Though I feel like specifically this year, 2022 has been a really big shift and I can feel it. It's really exciting. And even seeing a young Pakistani girl as a lead character in Marvel, like these things are huge for Asian people like myself. And I didn't grow up seeing any of this. So I agree. There's a shift happening, but I want that momentum to continue. And I don't want it to be that we're just telling Asian stories. I want us to just be in these fields enjoying the art as well.
That's a big question though, isn't it, in terms of who should tell what stories? You know, that is an ongoing discussion and debate. I mean, I've always been of the view I mean, I think we have probably a very different worldview on this. My view is that writers and creatives, that actually there's something quite liberating and wonderful trying to get into someone else's shoes, trying to tell a story that isn't your own. And I worry sometimes that there's a kind of policing of, let's just, what do they say? Stay in your lane.
Yeah.
Has been the thing. And I'm not sure that's good for artistic expression. Mm. By the same token, I can completely see your point that if there are no authentic voices from within a community being presented, then all you get is the caricature.
That's it.
So is there not, there's room for both, is what I'm saying.
And that's it. That's what I will hopefully see happening, is that there is room for both, because there will be people telling it from their voice, and there will be people who want to explore that in their art form of sharing stories that aren't their own.
Yeah.
But you're absolutely right. If we don't have the latter, if we don't have those people from those communities sharing their story, then what we're going to have is this kind of caricature, these stereotypes, these old storytelling, kind of outdated storytelling, kind of continuously happening. So I think both is possible, but you do need the latter to be happening for yes. it to not be this kind of destructive storytelling.
But that's why, you know, with books like yourself, your book here, you know, it's such, you know, it's your story, and it's people who have had no experience. I have no experience of a lot of this stuff. Mm. And just really interesting to read that perspective and understand where people are coming from, I think.
Yeah.
I want to ask you, though, about this idea of identity. And obviously, identity is very, very important to you. Mm. Is it the case that, is it because if you come from a minority ethnic group within a majority white country, mm-hmm. it matters far more than for people who just take it for granted? Is it that you notice things that other people don't notice, that you have a unique perspective on these things?
Yeah, I don't think it's just I notice things people don't notice. It's just growing up, realizing that existing in this body as an Asian woman, everywhere I go will be slightly different compared to my counterparts who will be in a white body. Mm-hmm. My experiences will be different. And sometimes that can be a positive thing, sometimes that can be a negative thing. And that's what this book is trying to convey, why it can be wonderful and beautiful and empowering that I'm different, but the struggles that come along with that as well. And I think that's what for minority communities, what we're trying to explain sometimes, yeah. that this is what we might be facing. This is why when I walk into a room, my experience will be completely different to, say, a white woman will be.
Yeah.
So,
but you're also quite clear to say that you're not talking about racial groups being homogenous.
No.
That actually everyone's experience is completely different.
Completely different. The South Asian community is not one homogenous yeah. group. We've got so many different cultural backgrounds, faith backgrounds, depending on where you live geographically, class. There's so many kind of intersecting factors that will make all of our experiences so different. So I highlight that at the very start of the book in the introduction of saying, yes, I'm talking to brown women and girls, but we are not one homogenous group. If you are a Muslim woman, your experiences are going to be very different to a Hindu woman. If you are working class, your experiences are going to be absolutely different from a different class. So recognizing those differences and how there are minorities within these minorities as well. I come from a Punjabi Sikh background. So the Sikh community in India is a minority population. Mm. We've got a tiny percentage in India, predominantly in northern India, based in Punjab. Punjab geographically also has an interesting history because it was split during Indian independence and partition in 1947. So half of Punjab is on the India side, half of it is in the Pakistan side.
Yes.
So the Sikh Punjabi community are a minority within a minority that don't necessarily have a homeland per se, are marginalized within India, and here in the UK are also a tiny population as well. Visually, we stand out quite a bit because you know who a Sikh man is. Mm. He's a turban wearing, bearded Sikh man. So our experiences are really interesting of we are a minority within a minority. Sometimes our voice doesn't get heard. People do know who we are, but we don't know who we are. Mm. And in the post 9/11 world, Sikhs also had a very interesting experience of how we're being treated in the world yeah. post 9/11. If you are a bearded Sikh man, you're going to be treated with so much more hostility than you were prior to that. So yeah, it's understanding all these nuances. It's like yeah. there's so much there to understand. And I recognize it's difficult for us to know everything about everybody, and that's going to be hard. But by reading books like this and understanding experiences that aren't your own, and In the book, I recommend having a shelf reflection of looking at your bookshelf and considering, do you have books on your shelf by Black and Asian authors? If you don't, maybe go pick some up and read some of these stories and understand these different perspectives. And ultimately, that's what's going to make us a better society by doing this.
Because I think that's a really important thing to acknowledge, because I sort of lose patience with excesses on all sides of the argument. So when people just refuse to acknowledge that being a different colour, a different sexuality does have an impact within society, and you do experience things differently, I think that's important to acknowledge. But I find the excesses of identity politics fall into the trap that you sort of describe, of ending up sort of saying this experience is like this, even though it's composed of all sorts of individuals with all sorts of individual stories. And I think anything that reduces things to just a sort of monolithic perception isn't really helpful to the conversation. But I think both sides are guilty of that within whatever you call this, the culture war.
And media, social media, mass media, it all has a role to play in this, because that's what ends up happening. We're just seeing kind of these pockets here and there, or the headlines or the taglines that grab the most attention. And this is where we miss all the really kind of fruitful parts of some of these conversations. And that's why I recognize that my role as an educator, my role as a teacher within schools, working with young people, sometimes is where I feel I find more joy, because in the classroom or when I go to universities, I can have some of these really great conversations. Mm. And sometimes that just gets missed when I'm talking to adults. So that's where I can.
What sort of age group do you mostly teach?
So I was trained as a secondary school teacher. Yeah. So from year seven, where they're as young as 11, all the way up to sixth form, so they're 18. So that whole teenage, wonderful age. But I work with a lot of universities now as well. So, 18 to 21.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's, I say this because I taught secondary as well, but I think it's hard.
Oh my God, it's hard.
Although that said, I sat in on some primary school lessons to sort of get, that's difficult for a different reason.
Yeah, so I don't think I could do primary. Oh my God, I really admire primary school teachers, because imagine a class of 30 plus.
Yeah.
Five-year-olds.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that. And you have to keep them occupied all the time. You can't just set them an essay and get on with it.
Let them get on with it for an hour. No. So I empathise with all teachers at all age groups. Yeah.
And you teach history, but are there opportunities for you to talk about your poetry within when you talk to the kids, or get them to try and create their own work as well within?
I would bring poetry within history teaching. I also taught sociology and politics. I'd bring some of that creative work into the classroom, because history sometimes isn't the most popular subject in schools, and you've definitely got students who already have their kind of preconceptions about history being boring. And also, I don't look like your typical history teacher either. So I recognize that I wanted to make history really accessible to young people. And sometimes when I was teaching the topics that are a little bit more boring or a little bit more tiresome, I would see how could I bring something more creative into that. So I would bring spoken word poetry into some of my lessons. And when I'd be teaching about, I don't know, maybe it was civil rights movement, maybe it was about the Tudors, maybe it was about the Vietnam War, we would sometimes write poetry pieces as a way to memorize some of the information, or to understand certain people's context or the environment, or kind of bringing some of that creative work into history. I think there's definitely ways that you can bring some of that into different subjects.
How do you feel about the teaching of history at the moment? Because there's been so much debate about, we need to expand the curriculum, we need to talk about voices that haven't been heard before, stories we haven't been heard before. Mm-hmm. How much do kids really learn about the Raj? How much do they learn about the empire? Mm. And I get different, because I've spoken to lots of different history teachers about this, and everyone seems to have a different perspective, largely because there's so much you could teach, right? Something is going to be left out. It's sort of hard. Do you feel there are any priorities we need to take at the moment?
Yeah, I guess there's definitely this conversation specifically about empire, about how should empire be taught. And I guess with that particular topic, it does need to be reflected on in our national curriculum about how it's being taught. And traditionally, it has been taught from textbooks as a really glorious thing. And again, we're missing all the nuance about why it wasn't always so glorious, where there were the atrocities, what happened to many of these colonies and these nations and these people. So it's missing kind of half of the story, right? So that's definitely something that needs to be considered in the history curriculum. But I think there's a wider thing to be considered here. I absolutely agree that we need to diversify the curriculum, make it more inclusive, have more of these stories in there. But then when you also then consider that we now have a makeup of almost 60 to 70% of our schools in the UK are now academies. The remaining amount are then state comprehensives, yeah, private schools, independent schools. You then have religious schools. Not all of our schools are teaching the same curriculum. So academies don't actually have to abide by the national curriculum in the same way that state comprehensives do. They can actually have more flexibility in what they teach. They have to follow certain criteria, but then it's up to the academy on what they decide to teach. So that's predominantly what our number of schools are in the UK. Then having a new national curriculum actually won't make that much of a difference. So I think there's a wider conversation that needs to be had about our schooling systems, about what our education system actually looks like in the UK, as well as what our curriculum needs to look like.
Yes.
Do you
think that, I mean, you talk in the book a bit about the idea of introducing anti-racist policies into schools, and the idea of, and of course, that's a big discussion because schools already are very good at handling racism in within schools, and we're all against that, and that against racism, and that should be in place. But the discourse of anti-racism often tips into the ideological, the idea that, I mean, you mentioned white privilege and power structures relating to race, but all of this is quite contested. Do you think we need to have more conversations about that before we implement them into schools?
I think if we look at some of the incidents that have happened in the last 3-4 years of incidents, specifically for children of colour that are happening in the schools, I have to say that I personally right now feel that schools are not necessarily the safest place for children of colour. And that's really sad to say, because our schools should be a safe place for all kids.
What makes you say that?
If we look at some of the recent incidents of a student being strip searched.
I saw this, yeah.
In school. And if we look at the number of suicides taking place of children of colour in the last couple of years because they've been bullied. If we look at some of these statistics and some of these examples, it's really harrowing. This is scary that we're allowing some of these things to happen within schools. And what I'm saying by having some of these kind of anti-racist policies in schools is that we do need to flag that there are some of these institutional things that have been there for many, many years that aren't considering that for children of colour, what they're experiencing in schools might be different to their white counterparts, and just recognizing what's going on there.
Yeah.
And what I'm saying is that this should just be a part of school policies in the same way that we look at health and safety, the same way that we consider safeguarding. We need to have these things within those policies. And it's a part of the school's ethos to recognize gender, sexuality, race, religion, and recognize that experiences might be different for certain kids compared to others. And I don't feel schools are recognizing that enough at the moment. And I don't feel like that has to be, it has to get nasty. I don't think that has to be a really contested argument. I think that just needs to be something in the same way we would consider that we want our kids to be safeguarded in schools. I think this sort of stuff to do with race needs to be kind of had in that conversation as well.
But do you recognise that there are different perspectives on this? Because the concern that a lot of people have expressed to me, and when I'm talking about activists, people of colour who are involved with schools and education, their concern is that if we teach kids to see themselves first and foremost through the prism of race, and then as an individual second, we end up you end up in the situation where, I don't know if you know about the American school, literally dividing kids by skin colour for their extracurricular activities. Mm. That strikes a lot of people as, that's not the way. Because I think the goal is the same. Mm. I think the goal, your goal and their sort of opposing goal is actually, we need everyone to be equal, treated equally, to feel comfortable. Mm. But when you have policies that are implemented that end up with that kind of divisive outcome, does that make you nervous at all?
I don't see it as divisive. I don't think this is going to make children feel that I am different to other people because of seeing my skin colour first. What I'm suggesting is that from top down, that teachers and senior leaders need to be recognising some of these issues are happening so that they can make sure all those children feel safe and equal to one another. So that's what I'm suggesting, that the policies, the actual education system needs to be considering these things so those children can feel that they are equal in the classroom. And
your view is that at present they don't on the whole?
I feel right now they are recognising they're being treated differently. Some of these examples that I've just mentioned is that Black children are feeling like they're not being treated the same as white students. Asian kids also, in even in the book, if I'm talking about South Asian girls and looking at that perspective specifically for the cohort that I've researched and studied, Asian girls academically are doing really well yeah. in the UK at GCSE level, at A level. We're kind of the second smartest in the country. We follow closely behind Chinese boys and girls. So academically, we're doing really well. But then that starts to dwindle off when you get to university. Asian girls are some of the lowest represented in Russell Group University at Oxbridge. We're hardly there. And then when you then go post-university and look at the workplace, you barely see any Asian women in any CEO roles or any kind of those top leadership roles. So what's going on there? What's going on with that trajectory of we work really hard, but why is that not being recognized? And what I'm suggesting in schools is that teachers do need to be recognizing perhaps some of the stereotypes that are in place about Asian girls. And I even firsthand experienced in university when I was studying history, I was waiting outside of one of my lecture rooms. The previous class left the room and they left that seminar class. And the last to leave that room were a group of Asian girls, and they left the room. And I picked up my bag and I was about to go into the class. And I overheard my lecturer say to the seminar teacher, "There's no point raising their aspirations because they're just going to get married after uni anyway." And I had to hear that firsthand and walked into the seminar room and didn't know what to do. I just pretended I didn't hear it, said hello to them, sat down and sat there for the next hour considering what just happened. Mm-hmm. And like, how can educators feel that way? That where are some of these ideals coming from? And that's why some of these discussions need to happen at kind of a top-down level.
I think that's a really good example. I remember you mentioned that in the book as well, because that's the kind of thing where I think our perspectives are different insofar as I would see that and think, that's an outrageous thing to say. Why is that person saying that? And I think your view is that is the symptom of something bigger, something bigger. Structural.
Yeah, I don't see that as that individual. I'm not seeing it as that one person. I'm seeing that was an idea that's been rooted in something bigger. So where has that idea come from?
That we've ended up with those different perspectives. Because, you know, I've come from a minority background myself. Mm-hmm. But I always take it seriously when people say, look, I think there is a structural issue within this organization. I think that deserves interrogation, looking into. Mm. But I worry sometimes that there's an assumption that there's a structural problem, when sometimes there can be just people who are behaving very badly and need to be pulled up
and pulled up in it and held accountable for it, because sometimes there are just people with that individual kind of feeling. But I think from a number of different experiences, not only myself, but then the number of other Asian women I interviewed, then looking at some of the studies done about this, the statistics around it, it seemed that this was an institutional problem, that Asian girls are being treated a certain way in the education system, that they're seen as the wrong kind of learner. They're seen as too quiet, too submissive compared to other types of learners, usually boys who are a bit more outspoken, more confident in the classroom. But then academically, we're doing really well in the exams. We know how to work hard. And this kind of goes hand in hand with the whole kind of minority myth of work twice as hard and you'll do really well. And even for myself as growing up, I realized that as I got older that, yeah, I'm working really hard, but how come it's even harder for me to get to X, Y, and Z? Yeah. Why is that? And all I'm trying to do is question these things.
Yeah, and I think that's very valuable.
Be conscious that it's happening.
Absolutely, but there's a difficulty, isn't there? Because I mean, the example you just mentioned between boys and girls. Mm. Well, I've taught both boys and girls, and it's true that the boys tend to be more confident in class.
Yeah.
And but I don't want to think
not academically necessarily.
They don't do as well academically.
Yeah.
And then that puts a teacher in a difficult position because. Mm-hmm. You know, you're open to the accusation of bias if I assume boys are going to be more confident. But then I've experienced, and I know that is often the case. So then how do you sort of manage those, acknowledging a reality in order to fix the reality?
Yeah.
And putting yourself in a position where you're being accused of making assumptions?
Yeah. Well, recognizing that is a reality, because if we look at it, this is what teachers are collectively saying that they can see happening in the classroom. So this is coming from some proof. This is coming from some evidence. This isn't just one-off people saying that this is what I've experienced. I think there's been studies going on about this for almost kind of five decades about kind of the differences between boys and girls in the classroom. And then more recently, different ethnic minorities in the classroom as well. So for teachers, it's then about, okay, how do you handle those situations? What do teachers do in those certain circumstances? Yeah. Because You want the boys in the classroom to feel like they have a voice, they can share their opinion, but you need to be uplifting the ones that feel like they can't. So what do
we... Well, I always used to sort of try and make a point of calling on, you know what I mean, when you're asking questions, with the people who were shyer or the people who wouldn't,
That's sometimes terrifying for that student.
Exactly.
I was that student sitting at the back of class like, please don't pick me, don't pick me.
But you understand why why you want to do that as a teacher, because you want to bring people in.
Yeah, and how do you do that? Sometimes without making them feel picked on and individually making them kind of feel like, oh, now I'm going to have to speak in front of the entire class. What do we do to kind of boost their confidence a little bit, make them feel prepared before they have to answer that question? And that was stuff that I was trying to put into place as a teacher. How do I make sure that everyone in the room has an answer ready, prepared, so they feel a bit more confident when it then gets to the point of, okay, I want to see by the end of this lesson that everybody's put their hand up at least once. And
well, it depends on them putting the work in, doesn't it?
Sometimes. Yeah, and then sometimes that doesn't happen. Yeah. So yeah, it's a struggle, but yeah.
Because similarly, that's another thing you discuss about the expectations of brown girls at school and to be, even to the extent that they tend not to do as many extracurricular activities, or they're like you say, outperforming most other groups in terms of academics.
Yeah.
But maybe that comes with a cost, perhaps.
Yeah, and it's interesting, even that example of extracurricular activities, a lot of this has been put down to, well, Asian girls aren't allowed to do extracurricular activities because of their families and their culture. Which isn't always the case. Yeah. That's a factor to consider, of course, but that isn't always the case. There are other factors for why they might not be doing that. So how, as educators, do we make sure they still feel included? Maybe recognizing some of those cultural issues and some of that stuff that is coming from the family, but also recognizing that isn't the only thing. And I've been involved in some amazing organizations recently and programs that are looking into some of these things. For example, there's this Future Leaders program that I'm involved in with a school in East London. And predominantly the girls on that program are Asian girls. And the teachers recognize that they can't be holding a lot of these programs and activities late at night because their families don't deem that acceptable. So it's like, okay, how do you balance that? So some of the parents found it more acceptable that the girls were going on school trips. So as long as a teacher was with them and it was a part of a school kind of program, that's okay for them to attend certain things. They felt more comfortable with things taking place at lunchtimes and directly after school rather than too late in the evening. So it's kind of managing some of those kind of cultural expectations and those family issues there.
Yeah.
But then also making sure we are uplifting these girls and we are empowering them. And it is a leadership program, so we want them to get the most out of it. So, yeah, looking at kind of both sides of it.
Yeah. Can I ask you a little bit about cultural appropriation? You have a whole chapter on this.
Yeah.
And I'm very skeptical about this whole debate.
Yeah.
And I'm going to give you an example of, and one of the reasons why it always bothered me a little. So there was you will have heard of this. There was an American girl, a white girl, who dressed in a Chinese prom dress, and she put it online. Mm-hmm. And she suddenly, and there was a Chinese American activist who attacked her online, saying, "Your my culture is not your goddamn prom dress." And you know, she's just a young girl. Mm-hmm. And it went viral, and there were all sorts of back and, well, you know what Twitter's like.
Yeah.
But then most of the support she got was from Chinese people, from the Chinese community, saying, mm-hmm. "You look beautiful. Mm-hmm. Why shouldn't you wear this dress that comes from our culture?" Mm-hmm. You seem to take a different view on that. Am I misreading that, or are you?
A slightly different perspective on it. That's probably quite an interesting example, though, of a young girl wearing it as a prom dress. And yes, seeing the two sides of that argument, some people would see that as a form of appropriation. Is she wearing it as a costume? Is she wearing it because she feels that she can, whereas perhaps that minority community sometimes feels like they couldn't. Would a Chinese girl perhaps feel as comfortable doing that in a predominantly white school? Mm-hmm. Quite an interesting situation there. But then the other side of the coin is people are arguing, well, that's her appreciating that culture and she looks beautiful and all those sides of it. And that's exactly why I wanted to dedicate a whole chapter to this topic, because it is quite a confusing one. And I recognize there is not one set answer to this, but with this age of social media, this cultural appropriation topic just kept coming up for the last 5-6 years. I kept seeing it everywhere. And it was I'd not seen anyone really dive into all the different aspects of it. Where has this term come from? What are the nuances behind it? And The definition of cultural appropriation is when a more dominant part of society, a more dominant culture, takes aspects from a less dominant part of our society and appropriates them, commodifies them, makes them fashionable, commercializes them. That's kind of what the definition is. But I like to describe it a bit better as kind of an unequal cultural exchange, because how I've personally seen it over the years is that certain aspects of minority cultures has been taken and made fashionable, commodified. Mm. We see it on runways, we see it in big fashion brands, whereas that minority community would not be able to reap those same benefits. If they wore them, it would be seen as that's so foreign, that's so different, that's not acceptable here. Yes. And then I gave an example of my mum and her migrating here in the late 70s. She got married to my dad in 1979, and that's when she first moved over from Punjab. And the clothes that she had were traditional Punjabi salwar kameez. She didn't have any Western English clothes at that point. And we used to have a corner shop in East London. Asian stereotype of having ever a corner shop, but we did. And mum used to be working at the till whilst dad was working other shifts. And she would have to hear on a daily basis, even in East London, which is quite a diverse area, people kind of sniggering at her clothes, making comments under their breath, comments on how she smelt, being called the P word by certain customers. And my mum got to the point where she was like, okay, maybe I shouldn't wear a salwar kameez in the shop every day. Maybe I should just wear Western clothes. And she borrowed my dad's naff jacket and bought a pair of jeans. And she started wearing that for quite some time, just so she didn't have to deal with that ridicule and that abuse on a daily basis. And then fast forward years later, and me and my mum are sitting having a cup of tea, and we've got the TV on in the background, and it's a music video playing. And it is a white Australian rapper, and she's wearing a traditional Indian lehenga, and she's kind of adorned in all the jewelry and all the makeup, and she's got kind of Bollywood backup dancers dancing behind her. And my mom just made a really brief comment. She wasn't even that offended by it. My mom actually said, doesn't she look beautiful? She looks really nice. Mm. But isn't it a shame that I couldn't wear that sort of stuff when I was her age? And that's when I recognized what cultural appropriation can feel like. And I think that's the important part of this conversation. We see all these fights happening on Twitter and people debating back and forth, but that feeling of what it can feel like when you're not allowed to wear your cultural items with pride and security and safety, but other people can.
That makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, of course, online disputes, what dispirited me about it was the abuse, actually, because I thought, you know, if we're talking about power structures, if we're talking about dominant groups, but this is just a teenage girl. This isn't someone who has made her name in the world. And,
yeah.
You know, and to be the center of that kind of storm is unpleasant.
Yeah. And recognizing she is a child, and she is still has lots more to learn about the world. And there is, I feel there is no space for abuse in that.
No. Set,
of course. How could we have done that better? How could that situation be handled better?
Or maybe she should have the right to wear the dress. Maybe, in other words, what I wanted to happen there was a conversation about some of the points you're raising, mm-hmm. maybe some counterpoints from other people. And we sort of, you know, that's what I'm always after. It's like a discussion through these things.
Of course. And the chapter then goes into how can we appreciate one another's cultures without appropriating them? Where is it actually appropriate for us to wear these things, for example? So the examples I've given in the book of when it was my wedding back in 2017, one of my best friends, who is a white young girl, wanted to be involved in the kind of cultural traditions. She wanted to be involved in the Punjabi wedding. So she did want to wear Punjabi clothing. And in that particular circumstance, yes, that's completely acceptable. She's coming to a Punjabi wedding. She is my best friend. It's not being seen as a costume. She wants to appreciate the cultural understandings of what a Punjabi wedding is like. I remember before the wedding, we met up for a coffee, sat there for 3 hours. She wanted to learn about all the traditions of a Sikh wedding, what happens on every day. She even was like, taking notes on a little notepad of wanting to really understand and learn what all these things are about. So she did wear Punjabi clothes at the wedding. She actually borrowed one of my mum's outfits to wear at the wedding. And that, to me, is a place where it is okay for her to be wearing that. Wearing it as a costume to a Halloween party, that's not acceptable.
Yeah.
Like, this is where we can start to distinguish where it's okay and where it's not. And that's where some of these conversations can lead to. I hope it can lead to.
Yeah, I think, you know, that all makes sense to me. I think where you and I part company is, I would argue that if someone wears a costume to a Halloween party, almost to fetishize or make fun of the culture, my response to that would be to say to them, what are you doing? Mm. Why are you doing that? Mm. Criticize, even ridicule, like whatever. Mm. But it wouldn't be to enforce, to say we need laws in place to prevent that. And I think there is a point in the book where you say you want laws in place to prevent that kind of thing. Can you explain how that could possibly work? Because ultimately we do have freedom of choice in terms of what we dress and all the rest of it.
The bit about speaking about laws and policies, and this was just me questioning it rather than suggesting that we need them, isn't so much on individuals, on circumstances like that, of like a Halloween costume. It was more considering when this happens at kind of a higher level amongst fashion brands.
Right.
Because I think that's where maybe there needs to be some form of legislation happening when we're seeing cultural items, that sometimes there's ideas or designs that have been created by Black creators, Asian creators, and they have been appropriated by some of these big brands.
Yeah.
And we're seeing them selling them for millions and millions of pounds and making lots of money out of them.
But you don't mean copyright, do you?
It's different to copyright. Right. This is why I'm kind of asking these questions, and I don't have the answer because this is definitely not my background, but wanted to put these questions out there for people to consider, that do we need to have more legislation in place when some of these circumstances happen and we recognize that it isn't just copyright, some of these things are, where are these things appropriated, and is there examples of appropriation? So kind of just starting to consider that
conversation. I think that was the thing that it just threw me when I read that, and I thought, because my approach is always, look, I'm going to write about this. I'm going to say why this is wrong. I'm going to, rather than, because once you get into legislation, then it almost feels like you're taking people's freedoms away. Mm. But there are examples of where I think criticism is always more powerful. Mm-hmm. But maybe I'm wrong about that.
Yeah. It's me posing these questions. And I guess this is definitely a space for whether it's lawyers to look at, whether this is for fashion brands to look at, how do they to handle these situations better.
What about art? Because when it comes to art and creativity, people have always borrowed from other cultures, and there's always been this rather wonderful overlap. Mm. And isn't that something to be encouraged?
Mm. And this is where a lot of, when I was looking into the studies behind appropriation, this is actually where the conversation actually started. It was in the art world that a lot of the appropriation conversations were starting. And it was exactly that. It was artists having these conversations of, can I borrow things from other cultures? Is that me appropriating, or is that me appreciating? And there is no set answer for this, but I think it goes back to the start of this conversation about the unequal cultural exchange. If you've got to consider that, can I do this and another person can't, that's where it is unequal. I think that's, even in the art world, that's where we might need to consider, are we appropriating?
So, because I wrote an article down about this, because I wanted to ask you specifically about this. There was this case in 2017, the Whitney Biennial Exhibition, and Dana Schultz, who's an artist, depicted the death of Emmett Till, the Black boy who was lynched. Horrible murder. Mm. But it's obviously, we're talking about a white artist. Mm. And she was accused of, what was she accused of? There were calls to destroy the painting. People were so angry about it. Mm. But what she's trying to do there is, I suppose, I mean, I don't know for sure because I don't know her, but, you know, drawing on human suffering as a universal. And is that something where you would say, look, that's not your story to tell? Mm-hmm. Or do you think that maybe the reaction to, say, destroy the painting is too much?
Mm. I can definitely empathize why members of perhaps the Black community or people that were looking at that particular piece of art might have felt that wasn't her story to tell. And if her argument was this was universal suffering, to convey universal suffering, well, that particular circumstance and that issue wasn't universal. It was how the Black community was being treated. So I definitely can resonate with people feeling like that perhaps wasn't her story to tell. And it's such a sensitive topic.
It's hugely sensitive, yeah.
That's why this particular example is so difficult, because the topic is so sensitive.
But isn't there something quite interesting as an artist to represent and talk about things that have not happened to you, or even people from where you're from, but I would say an artist should be able to express anything about anything they want, that there shouldn't be those limits.
I guess what I would like to see is if people are in positions where her piece of artwork was recognized and was perhaps seen by the world, would a black artist have got that same recognition? Even that is something that I'd like to maybe consider. If a black artist had created that same piece of work, would it have got as much recognition for it as she did?
Well, I guess
we don't know. These are all hypothetical
questions. But by your criteria, I think, because your criteria is, well, if a black artist couldn't have done that, but I think they could. I think we're in a world where that can happen.
That can absolutely happen. But I just wonder if they would have got the same recognition globally by, I don't know, the arts world as maybe she would have. And yeah, I guess these are just some of the questions I've thought about when I do see situations like this happen.
It just seems to me sometimes the reaction is so disproportionate if an artist inadvertently, but not even inadvertently, maybe quite consciously borrows from another culture. I don't know. These debates are going to go on and on.
Yeah.
But I think...
I think it goes back to even similar to what we were saying earlier about when we've only got kind of... when we're talking about storytelling and we're talking about if it's only people kind of outside of that community telling that story and it still stays quite stereotyped and caricatured if we don't have the people from that community authentically telling that story. I think maybe this is a similar example of, are people within that community or that minority or that group being able to tell as much from their voice and their stories?
Yes.
So maybe this is kind of like a similar example of that happening. We need to see more of those artists having the space to share their work as the others
And do. The example of your mother deliberately wearing Western clothes to avoid facing abuse, that's a very good example of that. I think that shows the progress, though, that's been made, you know, because that's a different time, you know, that's, and that's not to suggest that.
And she now wears her Salwar Kameez confidently. Yes, she's now kind of gone back the other way of wanting to wear them all again. And even for myself, as an Asian girl who was born here in the UK, and for a little bit of time, especially when I was a teenager, really wanting to deny myself of my culture, my heritage. Yes. And I think lots of us go through that at that age of like, we're very close to our culture, perhaps our faith and our heritage when we're young. And I remember I was speaking mainly Punjabi at home up until the age of 4.
Yeah.
Then you go into the schooling system, you become a teenager, you want to fit in like everybody does. But now in my 20s, and I recognize it's kind of like in our 20s, maybe in our 30s, that we then want to reconnect with our culture again and understand who we are and understand our roots and our identity and our history. And now, and exactly as the book is saying, how do we balance all those parts of our identity with pride, healthily, happily? Even the cover itself, I wanted to show that there are so many different things that make me who I am. It isn't just that I am an Asian woman. It's not just that I am brown. I'm also an East Londoner. I'm also a wife. I'm also a daughter. There's all these different roles I am. And I just want to live happily and joyfully and authentically as this. And that's what this book is ultimately saying.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. And you know, one of the things about reading the book is, you know, there are actually things you wouldn't expect it, but I can empathize with an awful lot. There are things, you know, coming from a teaching background myself, you know, having experiences where people assume things about me. That, you know, I think there are universal human things that come through hearing different stories. And that's why I sometimes worry that when identity politics goes so far that it just assumes there can be no understanding between people from different backgrounds. I'm not sure that's true.
Yeah, and I don't think that's true. And sometimes with this identity politics conversation, it's creating more divisions than it is bringing us together. The point of having these conversations is we want to bring us all together.
Right.
We want to make our communities closer and understand each other better, not separate us even more.
Yes. So on that, can I ask you a bit about these microaggressions, the idea of microaggressions? Because I worry about the discourse that surrounds microaggressions, the way it's discussed can create some of those divisions. Where I'm with you is I think it is perfect. I've seen it happen a million times. It's perfectly possible for people to inadvertently cause offense.
Yeah.
Maybe a cultural insensitivity. You point out mispronouncing names when you could have made the effort to learn how to pronounce the name. So stuff like that. But the phrase microaggression implies to me malevolent intent. You've gone out of you're trying to hurt someone. And that's not what I think is going on here.
Yeah, no. Microaggressions, the definition of a microaggression is it's sometimes this unconscious bias. It's not with malicious intent. And there's different types of microaggressions, from ones that are unconscious, they're not intentional, yes. It's just a thought that they've had or an idea that they thought was okay and they've been doing this for many years. It's not, and I think that word intention is really important. What is somebody's intention behind it? Perhaps their intention wasn't to offend, but that's just how it came out, or that's just what they thought was okay.
Yes.
All the way up into a point where it's a micro assault, where it's like, nah, that was intentional. You were trying to be horrible or make someone feel small or be mean or abusive. So there's a spectrum of how bad they can be. But ultimately, it's us educating ourselves on what things are okay to say, what things aren't okay to say, and coming back to our intention. And that's when sometimes I recognize when these microaggressions happen, what is somebody's intention behind it? Was their intention to be mean to me, or did they just not know better? And how can I help them on that?
Sometimes you'll never know, because it's what's going on in someone else's head.
Yeah, this is just human behavior. Yeah.
I suppose the worry I have is sometimes malevolence is assumed. If I can give you an example, I read an article recently about a London theater where one of the backstage stagehands, they're moving around in the dark, they're moving stuff around. Mm-hmm. There's a very tall black actor in front of them, and he asks him to move, and he says his name, but he says the name of a different black actor in the cast.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
He was fired for that and was accused of racism. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, that strikes me as an ungenerous interpretation of what happened there. He couldn't see who it was. Mm-hmm. He's standing behind him in the dark. Mm-hmm. It was an accident. That could easily happen. But there was an assumption that he just couldn't tell the black actors apart. Can you see how that's a sort of unfair overreaction to, and people, that creates a kind of fear then of, of what can I say, what should I say, that kind of thing.
Obviously, I don't know exactly what happened in that situation, and none of us will know exactly how that
happened.
Yeah, and none of us will know exactly what happened in that circumstance, but I can appreciate why this makes some people feel nervous. This whole conversation makes people feel nervous. Even bringing up the topic of microaggressions sometimes just makes people feel uncomfortable, because they feel they're being attacked by it.
Right.
But this is why we need to be discussing it more. This is why we do need to be talking about it more, so that we can deal with these situations better. I've done a lot of work with even now corporate companies who want to understand this better now, and diving into microaggressions a little bit more, because it used to be kind of a tick box exercise of, okay, let's have like one session on microaggressions or unconscious bias. We've done that and we've ticked that box. But now a lot of these companies are recognizing that, okay, no, we need to be building this into our culture, our ethos of being more inclusive, being more diverse. This needs to be a top-down approach. This needs to be in HR. This shouldn't just be a D&I network that covers it all in our companies anymore. This needs to be a part of the ethos of a company, so that we can do this all better. And people come to work feeling like they're included and accepted. And
I would agree. I'm all for that. But some of the policies that are interpreted as microaggression. So, for instance, Robin DiAngelo, in her new book, talks about how over smiling at people of color, it can be an aggressive thing to do, because you're not, I mean, it strikes me as absurd, actually. If you smile at someone, suddenly that can be interpreted as you compensating for your complicity in a white supremacist system. That's her argument. I mean, is that fair?
I guess it depends where she's where the argument's coming from. I don't know that one specifically, but I can resonate with experiences where I have been treated overly nice.
Okay.
And you feel that it's different to maybe someone else that's there. And it's really hard to describe what this like, because it is just a feeling. And this isn't me saying that person is racist, and this isn't me saying that person's a bad person. But sometimes I can feel someone's treating me a little bit differently. So maybe a little bit of that, of being overly accommodating or overly nice, because they're going out of their way to not seem.
But there's an assumption within that, though, isn't there?
Yeah.
You're assuming they're treating you differently, or maybe...
Again, it's
maybe
just this feeling sometimes.
Right, yeah, exactly.
And I'm not saying this happens all the time, but sometimes you just recognize it. And who knows what the answer is to that question? Maybe that person was just being really nice to you, because they were just being really nice. They wanted to be really nice. But yeah, sometimes it's just this feeling sometimes, and it makes you question it. But
I suppose that's what I'm getting at, is like, it invites you to assume the worst.
Yeah.
Sometimes this discourse invites that.
Yeah. And sometimes it's just people being nervous. Sometimes it's people being anxious just because that's who they are. Sometimes it might be someone who's just being overly nice, or it's these situations are difficult.
Well, you mentioned a specific one, which is the someone describing you as articulate. And I can see how that can be very patronizing. But then there was the recent case of Priyam Vardagopal at Cambridge, who accused a historian, I can't remember his name now, I've written it down, David Abulafia, because he described another black academic as eloquent. He was being complimentary, and she implied, she didn't state, but she implied he was being racist. But then she herself had described Benjamin Zephaniah as eloquent in an article 2 years before. You know, if someone describes me as eloquent, I'm like, great. I take that as a compliment. I take it for what it is.
Again, it's the intention. It's the intention behind it. And what I meant by that specific example is how it's said to me. It's in the tone it's sent. And it's literally that. It's the tone, it's the intention of how it's said. That same sentence could be said to me and I will feel a complete different way, depending on just how it's said. When it is in this kind of slightly shocking, surprised tone. You're really articulate.
You can actually say, I get that,
That's where the feeling of like, oh, that doesn't feel quite nice. Why are they suggesting that I'm not? Or and there's a number of layers to that. That could be class related, that could be race related, that could be gender related. Like, I don't know where that particular comment could have been coming from. But again, it's that intention behind it of how it was said to me and that tone of how it's said, or even the other really popular one of what Afua Hirsch calls the question of where are you from? And sometimes that question can just be, so where are you from? And that might be me saying, oh, I'm from West London now, or I'm from East London, or I'm from London. But when it's like, where are you from, or where are you really from? Trying to then dig into the fact that, well, you're not from here, so where are you actually really from? So it's how do you say these questions? How do you approach these questions? I'm not offended if somebody does ask, so where are you from? And I say, I'm from wherever. And if they then ask the question of, so where is your family from? And then want to know kind of what my background is. I'm not actually offended by that question. It's just how it's sometimes said.
Yes, because that could be just someone expressing an interest in...
Where have my family come from? But and
it's an interesting one, because obviously I'm never asked that question. And I spoke to a friend of mine about it, and I said to her, how often does this happen? And she says, oh yeah, it does happen quite a lot. It's that secondary question. It's not the where are you from, because I ask everyone where they're from. It's where are you really from, right? Now, I can't imagine ever saying that to someone, and I can't imagine what kind of person would do that, because it's so obviously... insinuating all sorts of things, you know. It's a bit psychotic, actually.
I'm glad you think that.
Well, it's just weird.
It's a bit weird. You're making somebody feel a bit awkward. You're making someone feel like they don't belong there.
So when does that? How often does that happen?
It happens often.
And is it strangers? Is it
It's strangers. It's in places of. Even in academic institutions, I've felt this. It's in places of even in leadership programs I've been involved in. I've felt this in quite a few places that this question comes up.
Well, I think that's a good example of somewhere where I think we'll both agree that's a problem. I just don't think... But I'd like to think that's not the norm. I'd like to think most people are a bit more... Because we all know people from different backgrounds and stuff. We don't go around...
And it's the point you were about to mention, that you wouldn't actually ask that person. If you were having this conversation with a white person, would you ask it in that same way?
I would say, where are you from?
Yeah, you'd say, where are you from? But you wouldn't question past that. It wouldn't be a question of, so where are you really from? And are you really going to go into their kind of historical background of where their family originated from?
But that's a good example of hearing what you've got to say about that, because I would never assume that that was a common question, because it's just not something I would ever ask. And so to hear that that is actually something, because it kind of implies, doesn't it imply a sense that they've got a preconception about what it means to be English
or British or whatever that means.
Exactly.
Absolutely. And that's what it is of what does that mean to people? And in that specific chapter, when I'm looking at that particular question of where are you really from, I've then taken the onus a little bit back on myself of, do I know the answer to that question for myself? And kind of doing some of that inner work of understanding what that means to me, where I'm really from, and starting to question myself about all those things. And the more confident I feel in myself about that answer, I won't feel as uncomfortable anymore when I get asked that question, and kind of know how to handle that question better.
Yeah. I think more discussions about it is good, because I do think a lot of people then get nervous and think, oh,
what I can't even ask it. Exactly. Oh, yeah, and I don't want people to feel like that. And you can tell sometimes there's a little bit of that in the air, or they're not even sure if they how to say that question. But again, it's all down to tone. It's the intention and how you say it. I feel that makes such a big difference.
Yeah. Mm. One of the other things you do in the book, which is really interesting, is that you talk a lot about physicality and about growing up and expectations and of how women should look, I suppose. Now, that is something I think that hasn't gone away. And that's something that is, I think it's not just about South Asian families.
I think that is
very much something that all women and men actually experience, this idea of body image and expectation of body image. Mm. So what do you think is the best way to tackle that? I think everyone I know is insecure about their body in some way.
Yeah. What I'm saying specifically for South Asian women is we have an extra layer that comes with some of that insecurity. Literally a layer of much thicker, darker body hair, and also skin tone, thinking about issues to do with colorism, issues to do with how we feel about our skin color.
And can you just explain what colorism is? Oh,
yeah, definitely. So in the chapter, I'm looking at body hair as one of the aspects of things that Asian women have to consider. The other one being our skin tone and the color of our skin. And within the South Asian community, we have issues of colorism, which is slightly different from racism. Racism, we understand, is when different communities have certain prejudices against one another, whereas colorism can go on within your own community. This is when you see specifically lighter skin as more superior to darker skin. And there's a number of different reasons for why this is happening in the South Asian community, and it goes quite far back. Some people are arguing, did this start during the colonial period of seeing white people as more superior? But some historians are saying, no, this goes back thousands of years when we look at some of the caste systems in South Asia, and we look at higher castes were seen as more superior with lighter skin. Whereas lower castes, untouchables, who would work outdoors, more laborious jobs, would have darker skin, so they would be seen as lesser.
So it was connected to working, with work and
class. So does it go back as far as that? So there's lots of different reasons for where some of these ideas have come from. But the fact that it's still happening now in 2022, and the fact that the skin lightening industry is a $1 billion industry.
Yeah.
Is crazy that there's still so much money going into these bleaching products, these skin lightening products. And Asian women are using them because they feel they've grown up in a world where lighter, whiter skin, hairless skin is seen as more beautiful.
A particular problem in this country as well, would you say that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the hair one's been a really interesting one over the last couple of years. And I bring it up in the chapter about during the pandemic, a lot of our hair salons, a lot of our beauty salons were closed. And a lot of women were starting to have an interesting conversation with their body hair, because for the first time in their lives, it's not an essential thing to get rid of anymore. And where does this come from of seeing body hair as so ugly, as so horrible, as so disgusted by it? And it's been really interesting looking at the feminist movement, specifically in the last couple of years, of now women are becoming more accepting of their body hair and their body in their natural state. And what we've seen a lot, especially online, is that in the feminist movement, a lot of the times we'd see body hair was on white women's bodies, which is lighter, sometimes thinner hair. Whereas the women of color who were sharing their body hair online, Asian women, black women, were treated with so much more disgust from people online compared to white women. So why is it that white celebrities could get away with it, but black and Asian women couldn't? So it's still some of that kind of unequal conversation going on here. So ultimately I'm trying to encourage women to love their bodies in all shapes, colors, forms, and to consider where some of their choices are coming from. It's absolutely up to you what you decide to do with your body hair or not. But is your choice coming from a place of being told that it needs to look a certain way to be beautiful? And do we need to stop idolizing whiter, lighter, hairless bodies as beautiful? And in recent years, I've been amazed to see now on kind of TV ads by some of these kind of big beauty brands, we are seeing more body hair on TV screens. We are seeing different skin tones, body shapes. And that's when we need to see that all bodies are beautiful, and this becomes normalized, that this isn't an issue anymore. When we see body hair, we're not disgusted by it anymore. And yeah, these things to do with body image, self-confidence, everybody's feeling it. Everybody's feeling insecure. Men are too. This is something that all of us need to be considering about: where do our choices come from? Where do our insecurities come from? And how ultimately do we start to love our bodies a little bit more?
I mean, I really sense when you're writing about this that you are thinking of younger people as well. You know, and particularly girls who are experiencing their first period, say, and you know, and their bodies are changing, and in that sense, I suppose it's you're trying to say, look, it's okay. Mm-hmm. You know, don't worry about it. Well, it's easier said than done, of course.
It's easier said than done. And to recognise they're not alone in these feelings. Mm. All of us are experiencing this at all ages, all backgrounds. We're not alone in this. So, yeah, some of those conversations, obviously, there is then the chapter on menstruation. Yeah. There is looking at brown bodies. We're looking at health. We're looking at a number of different things. So, a lot of these conversations are for some of those girls who might be going through that kind of transition moment during teenage years, and all these confusing questions are coming up, and wanting them to feel more confident and secure in their bodies, and recognize they're not alone in this.
So what's next for you? Are you going to write another book?
What's next? Oh my God. Yeah. What's next? Recovering from this one slightly at the moment. Yeah, I think I'm pretty exhausted right now, but yeah, already working on some of the next ones in the pipeline. And I guess there is still all my poetry ready to put out into the world, and thinking about what I want to do with that. I definitely love to explore kind of children's books as well, and the fiction space. But I guess at the heart of what I do is I'm still an educator. I'm still a teacher. I might not be in the classroom at the moment, but thinking of kind of new and interesting ways to educate. And for a long time, I thought that can only be in the classroom. But now I can see that there's lots of interesting ways outside of the classroom that I can be working kind of from the outside in to educate. So, yeah, more
and how
education.
Is the, how's it been since the book has been released? Has there been much sort of feedback, conversations, that kind of thing?
Yeah, lots of really interesting conversations, and that's what I wanted this book to spark, this dialogue, these conversations about these topics, really interesting conversations with Asian men about some of these topics, particularly brown dads have had really interesting conversations with, because it shouldn't be the case, but a lot of these brown dads who now recognize they have an Asian daughter, how am I going to raise a young brown girl in this world, in this political climate? And they're feeling this book is a toolkit for them on how they can raise their daughters better in this world. But obviously all the Asian women and girls that have been reading this book and feeling like they feel seen, they feel heard, they feel like they're not alone, a real sense of healing from this book. And that's all I could have hoped for. It's doing exactly what I wanted it to do. So, yeah, really happy.
Well, thanks ever so much for coming onto the show to talk about it.
Thank you.
This has been the Free Speech Nation podcast with me, Andrew Doyle, and my guest, Jaspreet Kaur. You can check out Jaspreet's book. It's called Brown Girl Like Me. And you can also find her on Twitter at @BehindTheNetra. And if you enjoyed the show, please do like and subscribe and tell your friends. And join me again next week when I'll have another fabulous guest. See you then.